Good afternoon, everyone. It's great to resume the BRS Men's Afternoon Kollel. As always, we thank the Froelich Financial Group for their sponsorship. Today, I want to examine a topic which, unfortunately, is timely once again, and that is the halacha and the ethics of targeted assassinations. Why is it timely once again? After the Second Intifada, Israel very adeptly used this technique of targeted assassinations, identifying terrorists, those who associated with terrorists and those who were part of terrorist planning, and simply took them out, simply assassinated them. And it had a large effect. It's greatly credited with stemming much of that violence and of those attacks, because it drove much of their leadership underground. Imagine you can't lead as effectively, as freely, if you're worried that at any moment that your whereabouts are known or that you are accessible, that you could be eliminated. For whatever reason, Israel essentially suspended those attacks until just this week. We all know the 600 rockets that rained down on our brothers and sisters who have been in our tefillos, our heartfelt prayers. And Israel resumed, at least in this one case, they assassinated, that's exactly how you have to put it, they assassinated this financier who was the liaison between Hamas and Iran, who was the one coordinating the funding coming from Iran into Gaza and through Hamas and supporting terrorist planning and terrorist activities. And Israel resumed this strategy, this practice of a targeted assassination, taking him out. To many of us, this would be a very short topic to discuss. What's there to talk about? Somebody's involved in the planning and the execution of the murder of Jews, of anybody, so they've painted a target on their chest. One ethically, morally, halachically is entitled to eliminate them. But it's fascinating, a simple Google search, and you'll find that in fact, in the halls of academia and in the halls of international law, this is a hotly and widely debated topic. The ethics and the legality of targeted assassinations. Why is it debated? I'm not a lawyer or international policy expert. I can't speak to that. But it's debated because when a country targets and assassinates, eliminates somebody without putting them on trial, without giving them due process, without a chance for a day in court or justice, is simply executing with the death penalty without a trial, there's considered to be an element of a moral dilemma or even a moral violation. So there's a great discussion. The world did not applaud Israel's policy of targeted assassinations. Israel, interested in protecting her people, didn't really care. And they basically tried to put Hamas on notice this week to say, we're going to resume. We're going to drive you underground. We're going to make you fear for your life. We're going to resume this policy. And they did resume it in the one case. And maybe we'll do so more broadly. This topic has come up many, many times before. In fact, I gave a shir on it several years ago, which is the source sheets that we're going to examine today as the topic has come back. And why did I give it the first time? Because America essentially practiced a targeted assassination when it captured Osama bin Laden, who they likely could have captured without killing. Israel, what were the ethics of when Israel targeted the perpetrators of the Munich massacre, found their whereabouts, and eliminated them with an element of a revenge? So we have precedent, not only from Israel, but even from this country to a certain extent. Of course, they'll present it that it was in self-defense from Osama bin Laden that he was taken out. But let's say they could have captured him without taking him out. What would have been the ethics of coordinating a operation that in fact took him out? So there's an ethicist named Arthur Kaplan, Dr. Arthur Kaplan. He's the director of the Center for Bioethics at the University of Pennsylvania. My brother has a medical degree from there and also a master's in bioethics, and I believe had a relationship with him when he was there. So here in source number one, on page number one, he writes the following. When Osama bin Laden's death was announced, there was no doubt how Americans felt about his passing. Joy erupted across the country. People ran in the streets to celebrate. Cheers broke out at sporting events. Families of those murdered in the 9/11 attacks stated their relief. Yet, there are ethical questions that some are quietly asking on the occasion of the killing of the world's most notorious terrorist. This goes back now 8 years, 2011. Do we condone killing without a trial? Is assassination ever an ethical act? While it's tough to raise these questions about the demise of a despised figure like bin Laden, I think his killing was ethical. If any terrorist was ever a candidate to be deliberately wiped out, Osama bin Laden is surely that person. At a White House briefing, John Brennan said, quote, "We would have taken Bin Laden alive if we could. Although the team of U.S. Special Forces trained for both eventualities, taking him alive or engaging in a fight." If you skip down, you'll see Article 23B of the Hague Regulations, adopted by the U.S. and other nations in 1907, prohibits, quote, assassination, proscription, or outlawry of an enemy, putting a price upon an enemy's head, as well as offering a reward for an enemy dead or alive. In 1976, President Gerald Ford signed an executive order banning assassination. The events of 9/11 changed American policy. October 2001, President George Bush authorized CIA to carry out missions to assassinate Bin Laden and his supporters. He declared Bin Laden was wanted dead or alive, and President Obama maintained that policy. Is the killing of Osama Bin Laden an assassination? And if it is it morally right? Does it serve justice to hunt down our enemies and slay them rather than capture them and put them on trial? Do American values permit retribution for horrible crimes without worrying about due process? I think in some instances they do. And he goes on to make his argument and talks about he was essentially a military figure leading a band of combatants in a self-styled religious war. Military leaders are fair game. Essentially, Kaplan concludes that if you have a retired terrorist, they've moved into a retirement village inside a mountain where they're playing shuffleboard and mahjong and tennis and golf. They have retired. They're in the palm trees of the desert, and they've hung it up. And so they are categorically no longer posing a threat. If there were such a scenario that one could paint, that a terrorist would give up their terrorist activities, then maybe you could ask, is the targeted assassination as if it's an assassination in a vacuum? But so long as a person identifies and associates with terrorist activities, they are an enemy. You know, you assassinate the enemy, you don't put them on trial. When you're in war and somebody's trying to kill you, you don't first convene a trial. If they're trying to kill you, you take them out before they kill you. And his conclusion, Kaplan's conclusion, was that Bin Laden, in his role in leading terrorists, and maybe the most notorious terrorist, was therefore fair game because any interaction with him was the context of an ongoing war. So would we say the same thing? What would Halacha say? What is the status of a targeted assassination? Israel sends a drone over Gaza, doesn't risk any of its own men. The drone, which is armed, knows the whereabouts of a known terrorist. And the drone operator sitting comfortably in a caravan in Israel with his joystick or her joystick maneuvers and manipulates the drone into position. You know the terrorist is in a car all by himself. There are much more complicated ethical dilemmas. We had a speaker here several years ago who, using a PowerPoint, took us through. He would set up the scenario, then freeze frame and ask us what we think to do. And then he would describe what the Israeli army actually does. Very, very complicated, very, very serious moral dilemmas and conundrums. But let's say the terrorist is in the car by himself. And so there are no civilian casualties, potential civilian casualties, which even then one could argue that you're saving the masses. And just like in warfare, there are civilian casualties, but in the context of war, you have an enemy. So maybe the same thing here. But let's say the terrorist is by himself in a car, and the drone operator, from the comfort and safety of his own base, is going to press the button. The drone shoots the missile, blows up the car, takes out the terrorist. What are the ethics and what are the halacha? Rav Shlomo Aviner, source number two. Rav Aviner is the Rav of Beit El, the Rosh Yeshiva of Ateret Kohanim. He has a series called She'ela Shlomo. We quoted him on Shabbos in the context of the Shir of Protectia. And in it, he's asked the following. Is it ethical to kill a terrorist when it's logical to assume you'll no longer murder? This question can be divided into two parts, he writes. From the perspective of reality, how is it possible to be certain he stopped murdering? It's impossible to know. So meaning, a person who's already identified with terrorism is unlikely to ever retire from that pursuit. Whatever the cause or whatever the justification in their own mind that allows them, that their conscience allows their conscience to participate in acts of terror, it's unlikely they will ever retire or give up. Number two, even if we know we'll no longer murder, we must still kill him. But why? Isn't this the law of a rodef, a pursuer, in which a person is permitted to kill a pursuer so that the pursued person is safe from harm? If he's in pursuit, we kill him. But if he's not in pursuit, we do not kill him. So why are we allowed to kill the terrorist? If the terrorist is sitting around breaking pita with his family, and we've got a clear shot, in that moment, does he have the status of a rodef? That's Rav Aviner Shaila. As we'll get into the sugya of rodef, we know that normally, the halacha is, the chai bahem we learned in last week's parasha, that a person puts the continuation of our own lives supersedes the violation of mitzvos. V'chaybehem, the Mefarshim explained, V'chaybehem means Torah and mitzvos are there in order to enhance and to enrich our lives. If observing mitzvah means giving up your life, then that absolutely contradicts the whole purpose of mitzvos. Torah and mitzvos were given, we were given the charge in order to enhance our life. So if observing the mitzvah means sacrificing your life, then it's counterproductive. And so therefore, we sacrifice the mitzvah in order to continue our life, with the exception of the big three, the Arig V'Ayavor, two based on Psukim and one based on a Svara. The Svara is the murder. If someone puts a gun to your head and says, kill so-and-so or I'll kill you, you have to allow yourself to die. And there are many ethical dilemmas. In this case, already goes back to the Gemara and Rishonim, but unfortunately, tragically, has happened even in more recent times as we're still in the shadow of the Holocaust. You know, we know many cases where the Nazis, I'll never forget in the documentary, the movie Escape from Sobibor, it stuck with me since I was a child when I saw it in school. The scene in which some tried to escape the concentration camp, they were caught by the Nazis, they were lined up and they told the people who tried to escape, each of you choose someone else to die with you, otherwise we'll kill everyone at the lineup. Chalila, to imagine such a moral dilemma. The people who tried to escape were told, choose one other person to die with you, or else everyone in the lineup will die. What's the halacha? Do you choose someone? Are you entitled to designate somebody to death? Well, everyone's going to die if you don't, so they're going to die either way. But who are you to choose? That's the Gemara's svara, that the reason that one of the three cardinal sins is murder is because who's to say whose blood is redder, whose blood is thicker? So are you allowed to play God and decide who should die with you? Very, very difficult, very, very complicated. And of course, Avodah Zarah and Glila Arayas, if someone puts a gun to your head and says, worship Avodah Zarah or participate in promiscuity, in illicit relations, then you have to give up your life before you participate. So Reb Chaim says, the exception to this rule, that Ritzicha is Yarevi Ayavor, is the case of Rodef. Is the case of Rodef. If someone's chasing you to kill you, who says you're allowed to kill him? Maybe Yarevi Ayavor. Murder is Aser. Who says I'm allowed to turn and kill him if he's trying to kill me? Maybe better to give up my life than to engage in murder. Elamai, why is it I'm allowed to kill him? That's not an act of murder. It's an act of self-defense. What about the third party? If I see, I'm C, and I witness A pursuing B, and I, as a third party C, am allowed to confront A. I'm allowed to kill A in order to protect B. That's the halacha of Rodef. If I see one in pursuit of another, even if I'm not directly targeted, I'm not directly threatened, as a third party, I'm allowed to kill A. What happened to Yarev Yavor, or what happened to the Isser of Ritzicha? So again, this is an exception to that rule. So Rav Aviner is asking, I understand, I'm sitting in the cafe sipping my coffee, and I look outside and I see A is running down the street with a knife with a gun pursuing B, and going to murder, going to kill him in cold blood, and I have the capacity to trip him, to take him out, to shoot him. We'll see, by the way, what if I have the ability to just trip him? Am I allowed to shoot him? What if I have the ability to shoot him in the leg? Am I allowed to shoot him in the head? What is the halacha? Not the near duff, not the one, first of all, what is the halacha for the near duff? Is there a difference in the halacha for the near duff, the one being pursued, and the third party? So A is chasing B to kill him. Is B, and B has the ability to stop A without killing him. Is he allowed to kill him anyway? And what about C? C sees A trying to kill B, and C is able to stop A. Let's say C could stop A without killing him. Is he entitled to kill him? That's what we're going to see. But going back, Rav Aviner wonders, you sit in the cafe. Right now, if you see A trying to kill B, of course you take out A. But when Israel engages in a target assassination, who says that that individual has the status of the Rodef at the time, the terrorist? The terrorist is having a shawarma with his family. The terrorist is riding in the car on the way to prayers. Who says that he's the din of a Rodef that you're allowed to kill him? And to this, Rav Aviner answers three answers. Yes?
In your situation with the wall lined up, and assuming that the people know the brutality of the Nazis, that
right,
they're going to kill everyone anyway.
Right.
So what does he do?
So we're putting that question. We're not dealing with that question. It's a separate topic, a difficult, difficult topic. But coming back to Rav Aviner. So this terrorist is not engaged in an act of terrorism at the moment. But he's a card-carrying member of a terrorist organization. Social media page is filled with vows and pledges towards terrorist activity. What justification is there in killing him if he doesn't have the status of a rodef at that moment? He's not in real time in pursuit of someone to kill them. So Rav Avinair writes, there's three answers. Number one, the terrorist is not finished being a rodef. He's not an individual rodef. He's angry with a particular person and wants to kill him. He's a communal rodef who wants to kill Jews. And he doesn't care which Jews they are. If we capture or put him in jail and he's later released, as is the custom, to our great distress, he will continue to murder. The organization of parents of those murdered by terrorists has exact records, which state that more than 180 Jews have been murdered by released terrorists who've murdered again. That number is only more. This means that when you free a terrorist with the proper goal of helping Jews, you endanger more Jews. The person is therefore not a one-time rodef, but a perpetual rodef. So Rav Avinair is a big chiddush. But the status of a rodef is not just when a person is in real-time pursuit of another to kill them, but when a person is an enemy, they call zman, that they position themselves as an enemy, a vowed enemy who wants to kill you, they have a perpetual status of a rodef. The rodef has a particular individual in mind they want to kill. This individual has the status of a communal rodef. There's no particular person, they don't have a most wanted, they'll kill any Jew. And they're a sworn enemy who's willing to kill any Jew. They therefore carry that status of a rodef. And even if they're sitting having shawarma with their family, they're just on hiatus from radifa, from being a rodef. But even then, they are the status of a rodef that it's ethical and halachic to eliminate them. And Rav Avinair just puts in there that he thinks halachically it's preferable to kill him than to capture him. Even if maybe ethically it'd be better to capture if you could capture. But he says historically Israel has been positioned and pressured to have to release terrorists in exchange for kidnapped Israeli soldiers, is not Israeli people. And we know that when captured or terrorists that are released from prison, they go back to trying to kill Jews. They never stop. They never lose their status of rodef. Number one. Number two, halachic authorities say that you should kill him in order that others will see him be frightened. This rodef is teaching other rodefim through his action. If he kills Jews when the police approach, he gives up. We have mercy on him. We encourage others to act like him, endangering other Jews. In situations like these, we must be extremely ethical. The question is, ethical to whom? The rodef or other Jews? So A is chasing B, trying to kill him. And at the moment he's confronted by C, he puts up his hands. So if A was chasing B, trying to kill him because B took his bicycle or his computer, B took his car. So, okay, you're going to put him on trial. You're going to try to reconcile between the two. A can be healed. But if A throws up his arms only because he's caught, but given a future opportunity, he would continue to try to kill B. So he has not been stopped as a rodef. He is a perpetual rodef. And other rodefim are watching. And therefore, he needs to be eliminated as a incentive program, a motivation, that nobody should be engaged in trying to kill Jews. So who do we have to be ethical to? The Jew who did nothing wrong. And to him, since if we kill him, we stop him from killing others and lessen his Gehenna. We're also doing a favor to him, because if we capture him and then release him and he ends up killing a Jew, he is damned to eternal Gehenna. The Mishnah Sanhedrin says that Bensoro Mora is killed on account of his future. While he has done many things wrong, he has not committed a sin for which he's liable for capital punishment, but he's killed so that he will die innocent and not guilty. In our case, the terrorist is already liable, but he should die liable and not even more liable. We do not use the concept you should die innocent and not die guilty to create new laws, but to explain them. Meaning, that would not be a justification on its own to eliminate the terrorist. But on top of everything else, Rav Avinair says, the greater act of kindness, both to the Jewish people, the potential victim, and to the terrorist himself, is to eliminate him before he actually can carry out an act of terror. So if you have the capacity to do a targeted assassination, he has the status of both a perpetual rodef and a communal rodef, and you need to incentivize other potential rodefim not to join terrorist activities. And so for those two reasons so far, says Rav Avinair, it's ethical to eliminate a terrorist. Number three. There are halachas of war, and in war we don't lock up an enemy who's shooting at us, we fire back at him. This is similar to what Shaul said to the Keni, go depart, go down from among Amalek, lest I destroy you with them. It means, even though you're my friend, if you're there, you could get hurt. In the halachas of war, we don't make calculations. Tosfos raises a major difficulty with the statement. How can we say such a thing when according to halacha, it's forbidden to kill a non-Jew? Well, the Morris are the best of non-Jews. So Tosfos on Avodah Zarah explains, this statement refers to a time of war. This non-Jew seems pleasant. In our case, he killed, but he will be pleasant. We didn't make such a calculation at a time of war. Even pleasant-seeming non-Jew is killed. We therefore see that killing a terrorist is ethical. So these three reasons, Rav Avinair is perfectly comfortable paskening that a targeted assassination is both ethical, not only is it permissible, he would say, it's obligatory. If you have a terrorist in your sights and you could eliminate him before he can perpetrate more terror, then halachically you would be obligated to eliminate him. Just like in a time of war, and American law also has this distinction. You see, a cop, a police can't shoot. You know, if you're engaging somebody, there are rules of engagement, and there are Miranda rights, and so on and so forth. You don't have Miranda rights in war, right? And this was a great debate also with Guantanamo, right? And the people, because terror is a whole new type of war. At what point do you call them engaged in war? When do you name them an enemy? In a classic war, you know who your enemy is. They're wearing the other uniform, they're carrying arms, and they're shooting at you. But this new war of terrorism, cyber terrorism, how do you identify at which point does a person become an enemy, and at which point is it declared war that you shift from the normal civilian rules and law to the rules that regulate warfare? So from a halachic perspective, the shift is very simple. When a person is avowed enemy trying to kill you, you're in war with them. And in war, there's different rules. There's no Miranda rights, and you don't handcuff him, and he doesn't have the right to a lawyer. If he's trying to kill you, and he's shooting at you, or he's poised, do you have to wait till your enemy pulls the trigger before you can pull the trigger back? Let's say your enemy's setting up their gun. They're looking through their sight. Are you allowed to shoot? Or you have to wait till he shoots one at you, and then you could shoot? War has a whole different ethic. So even if the terrorist is breaking bread, terrorist is in transport to their next terrorist activity, they're still engaged in an act of terrorism. They're the enemy. And therefore, says Rav Avinah, there's no hesitation to take him out. That's not our topic for today, but it's a separate question. Because that's what he said his third point, Rav Avinah, was, is that in war, we also have different calculations about civilians.
I mean, are you required to warn them that you're going to bomb them?
Major ethical questions. Okay, let's see some of the sources he's referencing now inside.
How does it apply to this thing?
That's also a person rises to kill you. What? A person rises to kill you. It's self-defense.
Yeah, but does he actually have to come in?
So that's what Ryanair's point was. When somebody breaks into my house and they're climbing into my bedroom window and they're going to try to kill me, it's clear they're trying to kill me. I'm entitled to kill them first. But this terrorist, that was exactly the whole basis of his question. In the targeted assassination, the terrorist is not engaged in an act of terrorism. Meaning, if you know someone with a suicide vest is walking towards a cafe and has their hand on the detonator, then no one would debate that you can kill them. Mm-hmm. The question is that this targeted assassination is against a terrorist who's not engaged in the moment in the execution of an act of terrorism. So one might argue it's unethical without a trial to assassinate. You're assassinating somebody having dinner with the family. You're assassinating dinner with somebody. You're assassinating somebody who's in the car on their way to somewhere. They're not in an act, engaged in an act of terrorism. Is it ethical and is it halachic to take them out? And these are Rav Avinah's three reasons why it would be. There's another, we're focused on the target assassinations. I'm giving you all kinds of other corollaries of it, which we're not talking about. But there's another corollary. What are the ethics of if you know somebody has information about somebody else, about the perpetrated terrorist activity? So, A knows that B is on their way to a mall to blow themselves up. What are the ethics of torturing A to get the information? The only way to save innocent people from B, who's going to perpetrate an act of terrorism and a murder, is to torture A. What are the ethics of torturing A? What if you had to kill A for whatever reason to stop B? What are the ethics of killing A to stop B? What?
You're killing him, you're not accomplishing anything.
You're not accomplishing anything, but let's say...
If you torture him and gives you permission, information, that is...
Okay, but let's say A is B's son, wife, mother. And you're on a radio with B and you say, abort this mission, turn yourself in, or I'm going to kill A.
That's another story. Yeah.
And then you need to shoot him in the leg in order to let B know that you mean business. What did A do? Does A have the din of a rodef? Sort of a passive rodef. They're a passive rodef in the sense that they're the obstacle to... So there's a lot of corollaries of this question. So this comes from a Mishnah in Sanhedrin. Let's go through some of the sources. Source number 3, on page number 3. The Mishnah in Sanhedrin on Daf Ayin Gimel. Eilen shematzilin osam benafshim. These are the people who can save from, at the cost of their lives. Harodef achachaveru lahargo. One who pursues his fellow to kill him. V'achara zocha v'achara nara morasa. So the Mishnah here, the previous Mishnah had taught that if someone's trying to kill you, you could kill them as an act of self-defense. And this Mishnah is continuing with other scenarios where a criminal is killed in order to prevent him from perpetrating another thing. And the Rambam codifies this in source 2. The Rambam Hilchos Chovah L'Mazik in the 8th parak writes, Mutar la'arag ha-moser b'chol makom afilu b'zman hazeh she'in danin din nefashos. If you know someone's a moser, not a moser like, you know, they go tell the parking attendant you double parked. Not a moser like that. We're talking about in antiquity or in the medieval time, the Rambam's time, a moser meant somebody went and informed to the government in a way that innocent Jewish lives would be taken. You die. So you're allowed to eliminate the moser, even though today we're not dundin in nefashos. Today we don't convene a beis din in order to hear capital crimes. We don't convene a beis din to execute. But if someone's a moser, if someone's an informant, think back to the 20th century, the Holocaust. If somebody's going to tell the Nazis where the Jews are hiding, reveal their hiding place, so they have the din of a moser, it'd be permissible to eliminate them before they threaten Jewish lives. You give him warning and you tell him, don't do it. If he says no, I'm going to inform, I'm going to turn you in, there's a mitzvah to eliminate him. And now, whoever has the great merit to eliminate him has been zocha. Continues the Rambam, Asa Amoser Asher Zamam Masar, Yeroi Lisha Asar Lahargo. Says the Rambam, it continues, if the Moser carried out his threat, and he informed on the Jew, it seems to me it's forbidden, once he was Moser already. Why? Elam Ken Huchza Glimsor Hareza Ya'anesh Shema Yimsor Achirim. So if the Moser has already been Moser, now the whole heter to eliminate him was he's a rodef. By informing on Jews in a way that threatens innocent lives, he has the status of a rodef. You're allowed to, more, you're obligated to eliminate a rodef. But once he's already informed, now you're not saving Jewish lives, unless he's the type of person, the profile of a person who's going to be Moser again. He's huchzak limsor. He's established a pattern. He's going to be Moser again. So then he should be killed also. Why? It's like our case of the terrorist. Now you're doing it prophylactically, preventatively. You're not killing him because in the moment, in real time, he's a Moser. He threatens Jewish lives. But if he has the pattern to be a Moser, there is potential Jewish life to be saved. And so on and so forth. The Rambam also, that's the, dealing with Moser, Hilchos Chovah L'Mazik. The Rambam Hilchos Rutzeach, source number 5, writes, Avzu mitzvos lo sasei lo lachos al nefesh harodev. So let's say you come along and you say, you know, I have such a good heart and such a soft heart and such a just heart, and I can't pull myself to pull the trigger. I can't kill another Jew, another human being. So true, A is trying to kill B, and I am the third party C. But I have rachmanas. I have rachamim on the rodef. Says the Rambam, mitzvahs lo sase. We have a lav not to pity a rodef. Laficha choru chachamisha ubra ashi mekshar leilid mutalachtoch ubra mea bein besam bein beya. This touches on another issue. Jews are not categorically against abortion. That's why we have a very nuanced approach to issues of legislation regarding abortion. Unlike Christians, who if there is a embryo or fetus that threatens the life of the mother, so Catholics believe, let the mother die and you save the fetus. That's why for many years Jews didn't give birth in Catholic hospitals. God forbid they faced that dilemma. They didn't want imposed on them a practice which is not our own. We paskin, the Mishnah is quite graphic, that you would chop up the baby and remove it in order to save the mother. Why? You have two lives. Shouldn't they be of equal value? Aren't the lives competing? Just like my Escape from Sobibor case, you're not allowed to choose one life over another. Why do you choose the mother over the baby? Because the baby has the status of a rodef. The baby doesn't have free will. The baby is not choosing to threaten his or her mother, but de facto, the baby is the circumstances threatening the mother. The baby has the status of a rodef, And so we kill the Rodef. And the Rambam here says, there's a lav to take pity. Let's say you say, I can't bring myself to abort this baby. So God will decide. And if it means we lose the mother, we lose the mother. I can't bring myself to abort the baby. Says the Rambam, you violated a lav. There's a lav of mitzvahs lo sase, shelo lachus al nefesh harodef. This is just supporting Rav Avinir's position. That if you have someone, the terrorist, who has the status of a perpetual rodef, a communal rodef, even if they're not engaged in real-time radifa, but like the Rambam with Mesira, they're huchzak limsor, they're huchzak lirdof, they're huchzak to be a terrorist, so that's ki'ilu, they're engaged in it at the moment. And to take pity and not eliminate them would be in violation of a lav. The Medrash Kohelet Zuta has a very powerful statement, source number 6. The Medrash says, Al ti tzadik harbe, quotes a pasuk, don't be exceedingly righteous. What does it mean? We think everybody should be a tzadik harbe. So Reb Shimon Lakish Omer, kol mi shenasa rachman b'makom achzari, sof shenasa achzari b'makom rachaman. Said Reish Lakish, whoever is merciful to the cruel will end up being cruel to the merciful. If you're merciful to the cruel, you're being cruel to the merciful. It's a binary choice. You can't have it both ways. You can't view yourself as being so loving, so liberal, so open-minded, so heartfelt, so sincere. You can't bring yourself. Because the kindness you're showing, the person who's cruel, is a cruelty that you're showing to the kind. So you can't bring yourself to abort the baby, the mother dies. It's a lav. You can't bring yourself to take out the moser. You can't bring yourself to confront the rodef. You're being cruel to the near duff. So that act of overzealousness in being ethical or overzealousness in examining the morality is in itself not kindness. Kindness to the cruel is cruelty to the kind in addition to being over a lav. Yes. Rambam does not quote a pasuk. So los mitzvahs los asay. It's got to be d'oraisa that lashon. Mitzvahs los asay. Yeah. It's a good question. I'm not sure the entire source or basis of it. The Gemara continues in Sanhedrin, and the Gemara says the following: Omar Abayi, b'yachol ha'atzel be'achad me'evarov. Let's say you have the following question now. So you've got the drone flying over the terrorist, and you want to incapacitate the terrorist, right? You want to debilitate the terrorist. You want to stop the terrorist from being able to participate or plan terrorist activities. So you could aim the drone, it's very exact, and you could take out his leg, shoot him in the arm. You can blow off his legs. Are you allowed to take him out altogether? So you could save yourself. What's the case? The Mishnah is referring to a case where it's possible to save the woman by disabling one of the pursuer's limbs. So you could save the near daf without killing the rodef just by disabling the rodef. Rabbi Yonah's son, Ben Shaul, who desan? Rabbi Yonah ben Shaul Omer, rodef shay rodef achar chaver lahargo. A pursuer is pursuing someone to kill them. A is trying to kill B. V'yochel atzilu be'achem evarav, and B can save himself. You could save the intended victim by disabling one of the pursuer's limbs. V'lo hitzil, and C, the rescuer did not save the victim through the means, but instead killed him. Neherag alav. Wow. A is pursuing B to kill him. C could have shot A in the leg, but instead kills him. C is now liable for a capital crime. Now, if C was scrambling and was panicking and doesn't have good aim and just happened to be, we're talking about C is a sharpshooter and had the peace of mind and the situation to have shot A in the leg, but chose to shoot A in the chest. C is now liable for a capital crime. What is the basis of that? And does that apply equally to the near daf or only to the third party? Only to the third party. Says the Rivash, source number 8 in his Tshuvas, says the Rivash, Efshe she'ena nirdaf ha'ba l'hatzel z'atma b'nafshe sh'rodev tzorech l'hatzros b'rodev. L'fi shu bo l'nafshe l'hatzel atzma v'l'chayvu l'hatzros. Now interestingly, we are not allowed to apply a capital punishment without first giving hasra. And hasra are very detailed laws. You have to warn the perpetrator before they do the act. You have to quote chapter and verse what they're about to do wrong. The witnesses have to see and hear the hasra be given. The perpetrator has to acknowledge they heard the hasra and yet commit the crime, and only then are they liable for the highest level of punishment. Which is why you can understand that the Gemara testifies that a Beis Din only executed and carried out capital punishments so infrequently. Because for all those variables and criteria to be in place and be fulfilled is so unusual and so infrequent. Very interesting, Hasra. My sixth grade daughter asked me the other day, I don't know how this came up in school, my sixth grade daughter asked me the other day, can a woman give Hasra? Why is that a question? Can a woman give Hasra?
She can't
be an aide, she can't testify. So do you have to be eligible to be a witness in order to give Hasra? So the Rambam in Hilchos Sanhedrin says, afilu isha afilu katan. Hasra is result-oriented. The witnesses have to see that Hasra was given, but the Hasra could be given by a monkey. The Hasra could be given by a computer. The Hasra could be given not by someone who's eligible to be a witness. The witnesses just have to know the Hasra was given. So now A is pursuing B to try to kill B. And B is entitled to turn around and shoot A. Does B first have to say to A, Hasra, stop trying to kill me. If you don't, I'm going to kill you. And here's the pasuk, and here's the halacha, and here's the psak, and here's the sif and shulchan aruch. Does B have to give Hasra? No. Says the Rivash, no. That's ridiculous. Hubahal anafsha, you're running trying to save your life. You hardly have the peace of mind, or the time, or the wherewithal to turn around and give Hasra. Elakevin shirosha, but lahargo yashkim huva yafech el rodef. He sees A is trying to pursue him. He could turn around and kill A. But the third party does not have that exemption. The third party does have to give Hasra. Just like the third party, if he could only shoot him in the limb and instead kills him, now has violated a capital crime. So to the third party who's saving the Nirdaf from the Rodef, now if by giving Hasra you're going to cost the Nirdaf their life, of course you don't give Hasra. The Rivash says, if you can save the third party, the near daf, and give the asura, you should. And so on and so forth. Fine. The Mishnah Lamelech, source number 9, based on this Rivash, says the following. Mavur perkoz abasra, zel shomar na beis Yosef, b'chiv zarajba, imroga lasas king, kol shomar lasas kilu asa, haru b'chlal haba lahargo, You see the second paragraph, the break? So he quotes this Rivash, and then he says, based on it, "Ein a nirdaf abal lahatzel zatzma nafshel rodef torch lahatzel rodef v'shum baol anafshel, because of sham ki yotze bekasav nedadar minim yochol lahatzel be'echem evar shel rodef she'in horgen asosh din zeh lo nemar ela bish acher habal lahatzel aval ha rodef ha nirdaf ein a medakdek bezeh." So just like this is the Mishnah Melech medayik from the Rivash's chiluk, the Rivash made a distinction between the nirdaf, the pursued, who doesn't have to give Hasra, and the third party who does have to give Hasra. He applies the Gemara and Sanhedrin with the same chiluk, that the nirdaf, the pursued, even if he could stop, immobilize the pursuer by just shooting him in his limbs, he's allowed to kill him anyway. The third party is the one who, if he can stop him by just killing him in his limbs, shooting him in his limbs, can't kill him. But the pursued, even if he could immobilize him and stop him just by shooting him one of his limbs, is allowed to kill him anyway. Why? That's the diuk of the Mishnah Melech to the Rivash. Because he's seeing the nirdaf as different from the third party. The nirdaf is different than the third party. The Gemara already made that distinction. The Rivash expands it in terms of Hasra, and therefore he applies the same. He applies the same. Okay. Now, Rav Aviner said, the third reason Rav Aviner gave, so we've now seen some sources that support Rav Aviner's first two reasons. The third reason that Rav Aviner gave was that, anyone remember? In a time of war, all's fair and game. War is different. The Netziv has a famous comment in his commentary on Chumash, in Zamek Davar, and he's a comment on the story of Shechem. What happens? Dinah is captured and raped, and her brothers Shimon and Levi decide they are going to take revenge. And using their Yiddish cup, they establish a brilliant strategy and a great plan. They are the original Mossad. And they tell Shechem ben Hamor, who wants to marry their sister. You know what? You're great people. I see no reason we can't assimilate and integrate our peoples. But for you to join, you have to get a bris milah. And then the third day after the bris milah, when they were the most vulnerable, they attacked and they took them all out. And of course, there's a great discussion and a great debate. I don't understand. What about communal punishment? What are the ethics of communal punishment? You know, there are some who say you should turn Gaza into a parking lot. 600 rockets are coming. What are the people in the world would tolerate one rocket threatening their people? And that the announcement should be made. There was a fake news that went out, or fantasy news yesterday, about a hypothetical speech Bibi should give in the Knesset about what he's going to do. Many people mistakenly thought it was actually given. It was wishful thinking. But why don't we practice communal punishment, collective punishment? We should announce one more rocket comes over, the electricity to Gaza is being turned off for a week. And make the people stop those who are perpetrating these activities. What are the ethics of collective punishment? And the halachic discussion about that question of collective punishment finds its first source, revolves around the conversation of Shimon and Levi and Shechem. What were the ethics of what they did in the story of Shechem? How could they kill everyone just because of the actions of the few? And the answer the Maharal gives in his commentary, Rashi, the Gerarie, and here the Netziv gives, Pershkash Baruch Hu, Imasai Adam Nenesh B'Shash Roy L'Nogachva, Masha'in Kim B'Shas Mechama V'Eis Lisno, As Eis Larog V'Eis Onesh Ein Onesh Azek Klal. Says, you're right, in peacetime, collective punishment is unethical. In a peacetime, when there should be Ava V'Achva between people, collective punishment is unethical, it's against Halacha. But in a time of war, there's no such thing as collective punishment. That's the whole nature of war. When you're dropping a bomb on people to protect yourself, the whole nature of war is that you're shooting at enemies. You're dropping bombs on enemies. You're trying to defeat and triumph over your enemy. So in the context of war, all the rules change. The rules of engagement are categorically different. And that's what Rav Aviner says. When terrorists, I don't care if they're coming out of the mosque in prayers, they're in their car on the way to poker night, or they're having a shawarma dinner with their family. Even if in that moment they're not a rodef engaged in an act of radifa, they are a perpetual rodef. They're a communal rodef. They are part of radifa activity. And therefore, like the moser, whose muchzak is a moser, then they can be and should be and must be. It's a lav to take pity on them. They must be eliminated. They must be eliminated. All the more so in a time of war. Are we in a time of war? So it's interesting. I'll never forget, we took a group of teens on a teen mission to Israel many moons ago when I was just a kolo rabbi, or maybe a young assistant rabbi with a full head of dark hair. And I'll never forget, we landed and we met the tour guide who put us on the bus and gave the kids their, you know, water bottle holder and all the tchotchkes that you get when you go on a tour to Israel. And he started asking the teens questions on the bus about modern Israel history. And he asked, you know, when was the Balfour Declaration? And when was the partition plan? And what happened, the War of Independence? When did it begin? And our informed, educated students gave the answer. And then he turned to them and he said, and when did the War of Independence end?
It didn't.
And the teens started to debate. Is this date, that date, when? And he said, it hasn't yet ended. The war has not yet ended. And that's not just hyperbole of a tour operator. That is the way Rav Schechter sees the halacha. Mori v'rabi, Rav Schechter, source 11, Be'ikve Atzon. Rav Schechter writes the following. B'nira da'av she'ein de'ein shama chayalim aravim ayorim betutuchim ve'ein aviyronim azorkim tzotzos. Even if in any given moment in Israel there's no one shooting a gun at you and there's no one in an airplane dropping a bomb on you and there's no one launching a rocket, even in that moment, mikomakam api halacha medinas Yisrael hayomi b'matzav shel melchama im ha'aravim. Jewish state is today in a perpetual status of at war with its hostile neighbors. Between the two wars, the Tafsu terroristim aravim shnei aviron maleim yehudim tayarim b'chazarasim eretz Yisrael America. Maybe some remember this Black September, when there were many hijackings. Our own Roni Rab, the Gabbai, our beloved Gabbai of Ashkava Minyan, was on the plane that Rav Huttner was on when the plane was hijacked. Every year Roni sponsors a kiddush in commemoration of Suda Soda for his being spared on that hijacked plane. His brother wrote a book called Black September. and he says they wanted to kill them all. Uben Ashvuyim had a goner of Yitzchak Kutner Zal, Rosh Hashivas Reb Chaim Berlin. Va'ala az alev chaver mitamidav asherin lagish kama milyone dolarim lemisra lachutz shel artus abris sheagishu heim hoon zel aravim hataristam amanash yishachar es rab magon Reb Hutner. So there was a wealthy Talmud of Chaim Berlin who was willing to put up millions of dollars in order to bribe, to get the release of Rav Hutner. V'donu az ha-rabbanim b'din ha-mishnah. So the rabbanim at the time debated, what's the halacha? What is the ethic, what's the halacha of ransoming a great Talmud Chacham at that time? Why? It's a mishnah in Gittin. Ein po din ha-sashvin yesu ha-kedei d'meyem. You do not pay an excessive ransom. Why? Mefarshim, the rush there in that Gemara, and the mishnah explains why. Because you're encouraging and incentivizing, just like when you release too many prisoners in exchange, you're incentivizing them to kidnap others. So the Mishnah says a din that you cannot pay excessively. So the Gemara is the one who says you can't pay excessively because you will motivate further kidnappings. So even if somebody wants to pay on their own, not just that you do not impose on the tzibur to come up with the funds, even if you have a billionaire who offers money on their own, we don't take it and we don't use it to bribe because we will motivate. Ayin shem v'tosos, t'v'shovay ha'muflag b'chachma mutilav tosa, afilu b'yosem echdei damav. Tosos says an exception is of a Talmud Chacham. That's the Rush quotes the story there of the Maharami Rutenberg, the whole story. So maybe a Talmud Chacham, you are allowed to pay excessively. V'huvu b'divrei shulchan aruch, we paskin like this in your day. So even though generally we don't overpay, we don't pay excessively, there were Tamidei Chachamim in that summer who said, we should nevertheless pay excessively for Rav Hutner. He has the status of what Shulchan Aruch Paskins, based on Tosfos, is a Talmud Chacham who's Muflug. So the great Rav Yaakov paskined against those Rabbanim and said, why? When is this whole calculation about overpaying in order to ransom and to free someone who's kidnapped, and the Talmud Chacham, you're allowed to overpay? That's in peacetime. But said Rav Yaakov, during wartime, if you overpay, you're giving resources to the enemy to continue to fight and to kill you. And therefore that cheshbon, that entire calculation falls apart. And you're not allowed to. V'himshech lomar, and Rav Yaakov paskins, yinei b'shnas tov shen ches, hekima mishos yehudah b'aretz Yisrael, v'nilchum b'hem kol aravim sh'vizoteyem, v'av shekvar hufsa ka'esh z'akam ashanem, yukom akom aravim adayin lo yishnuma medina, v'nimtzit shkol mechomas v'chol aporoz v'chol mehum sh'orcham aravim, hakol hemshech me'osa mechom arishon. Like the tour guide of Shechter Paskins, based on Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky, that Israel, the war of independence has not yet ended. Israel is in a perpetual state of war, has the status of a state of war. Mechemes ha-shechrur, Medinas Yisrael haisa matzav shel mechama, asa limsor ksafim l'misrad ha-chutz, and therefore Rav Yaakov paskind, they should not pay this excessive ransom, because that heter of Tosfos paskind in Yardea is only in a peacetime. In wartime, you cannot help the enemy by supplying them with such funds. That's a whole separate year, the prisoner exchange. And said of Shechter at the publication of Big Fat Zone, which already goes back some time, maybe 15, 20 years, that Israel still has that status. Israel still has that status. When Golda Meir called for the operation that took out the terrorist who perpetrated the Munich massacre, this is what she said to them, the last source. If you get all the names on the list, your mission is an incredible success. Get six or five, we'll feel the message has been sent that Jewish blood is not cheap, that will not sit idly by as the world did during the Holocaust. Even if you get only one or two, it will not have been in vain. But if you'll be faced with the choice between killing anyone on the list together with an innocent bystander or aborting your mission, your instructions are to do nothing. But she talks about eliminating the terrorists. It's a targeted assassination. When they took out the perpetrators of the Munich massacre, they were not in an act of terrorism, but they took them out because they were perpetual and communal rodfim who were muchzak in Radifa, and they had to disincentivize anyone else to be engaged in it as well. So we see that it's perfectly ethical and perfectly halachic from a Torah standpoint, these targeted assassinations. They've been effective, and unfortunately, tragically, the acts of this week call for Israel to have brought back these targeted assassinations. We end only with the tefillah, that Kadosh Baruch Hu should bring a true and a lasting peace between Israel and her neighbors, for our brothers and sisters in Israel and around the world.